This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome to the Urban Political. This week's podcast addresses the topic of mobilization and advocacy in context of massive urbanization. It's the first of two planned episodes, and we're very happy to have a special moderator for today's podcast, Abdul Malik Simon. Before we hand over to him, I'd like to ask our guests, and there are a few today, to briefly introduce themselves.
Hi, everyone. I'm Abdul Malik Simon. I'm a senior professorial fellow at the Urban Institute at the University of Sheffield. And I want to give a special welcome to my colleagues that have joined today. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sylvia Ahmed-Gacker. I'm a lecturer at Goldsmiths, University of London. I work on inequality, insecurity, and governance in Global South cities, with a particular focus on Pakistani cities.
Hello, everyone. My name is Taibat Lawansin. I'm an associate professor of urban planning at the University of Lagos in Nigeria. And my work over the years has focused on social complexities, urban realities, and the pursuit of spatial justice in Nigerian cities.
Hi, I'm Nitin Bartla. I'm a final year PhD student at ETH Zurich, currently on a mobility grant, through a mobility grant at the Humboldt University for a year, writing my PhD on Delhi Without Borders.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christian Sagim. I'm currently based in the Department of Geography in the University of the Philippines in Metro Manila. And I have done work on urban political ecologies in Manila's peripheries.
Okay, and I'm also here, Marcus Kipp from the Urban Political. I'm also very happy to be part in this conversation, although in the background. So to get us started, I'd like to hand over to Malik. Could you please frame the discussion that awaits us?
Thank you, Marcus. Today you're going to hear from colleagues who constitute one half of the participants in a school on massive urbanization. School in the tradition of the kind of critical Black thought notion of school, school as a kind of place of collective study, of collective deliberation, support, care, consultation, strategic thinking, and all different kinds of potential conspiracies. The school is opened up. It is an initiative of the. It's one of the schools being supported by the Urban Institute at a at the University of Sheffield, and in some sense it. It attempts to look at the notion of massive urbanization. Massive, not just in terms of big or voluminous, but in the sense of a kind of a Jamaican, the sort of Jamaican patois reference to the massive. One which is conveys a kind of inordinate insensitivity to conditions on the ground, a sense of things that are taking place to which those who experience and look at them are just not attuned to, but massive also in the sense of something emerging, a collective being born, about to take place. And so we have coalesced as a kind of collective around this issue, been discussing it. And today is an opportunity for half of our participants in this first part to give some of their reflections and ideas from their respective practices and urban contexts. And I also want to emphasize that this is a school that focuses exclusively, I mean, it is set up to focus on large urban regions across the South, massive urban regions, regions that seem to be expanding all of the time. And so we are a collective that whose work is ensconced within those particular contexts. So I would like to begin asking my colleagues that within this context of massive urbanizing processes, a kind of extensive urbanization that is being driven by a multiplicity of different actors and logics and processes and spatializations and temporalities, that some oftentimes seems that things, there's so many things that are taking place that it's difficult to account for all of the different kinds of directions and realities, even though we're well equipped with many kinds of analytical frameworks and tools. But from your respective urban context, what are the specific kinds of things taking place which you find it the most difficult to grasp, the most difficult to get your head around? And if you could talk about that a moment, and then talk about what it is that you do see, what it is that seems clear. So both sense, what is it that sort of remains elusive, too complex, and what is it that you do acknowledge, do have a sense of that's taking place? So perhaps if we could we go in a kind of alphabetical order.
Thank you, Malik, for the question. Perhaps one of the things I've been reflecting about in trying to make sense of Metro Manila's massive urbanization is how to make sense of kind of the different stories coming from different communities and different sites within the periphery. I've been involved in many projects in many different sites, and what I've been trying to kind of think about is how to kind of come up with coherent narrative in a way to adequately describe what's going on in the city and elsewhere. And in a way, I'm thinking about how to kind of decenter some of the questions and concerns about kind of studying Manila and its massive urbanization, which has kind of focused a lot on kind of massive issues, massive questions about dispossession, capital and resource flows, massive movements in kind of both sense of the word of movement. But also I was thinking about what if we could kind of invert how to think about massive urbanization from kind of the in-between spaces and the margins and the fleeting moments that do not lend itself easily to some of the existing toolkits that we have in urban studies and elsewhere. And I think this requires a sensitivity and kind of the diversity of the processes and overlapping histories and stories in different places. And starting from this, you get glimpses of these fragments in this whole scheme of massive urbanization. And I think they present kind of a modest window into the different urban worlds are being created. So for instance, I have been interested in tracing connections within and between cities, and how these connections bring different elements together, and how they are sustained, how they emerge, and with what implications for urban life, urban politics. And I'm thinking of what happened recently in parts of Metro Manila. A couple of weeks ago, there was a really massive flash flood that inundated and affected thousands of people in the eastern part of the city where you have the floodplain. And I think these kinds of events bring back the idea of how people are connected, how different sites and places are connected. In this case, in the context of the movement of water, movement of flows of water, and what happens in, for example, one part of the city has implications for those in other parts of the cities. And through this, I'm thinking about how we could look at both connections between places, and looking from this in-between spaces and margins, and how they are, I think, generative in kind of making sense of the massiveness. So we cannot do it in as one person, one scholar could not make sense of all this massiveness and all these processes. But collectively, if we look into kind of fragments or components or parts of these different massive movements, and I think those are sites I think that are generative and productive in thinking about all these questions.
Thank you, Christian, and thank you for this kind of formalization, that reminding us that these urban regions such as Manila are really full of eventfulness, from as you're saying, mass flooding, the kinds of extrajudicial policing of low-income areas, and that the multiplicity of these eventfulness does create all kinds of in-betweens as well, because these events are not necessarily on the surface easily connected to each other. And so the notion of how you look in between those kinds of events, as well as the kinds of spaces you're talking about, are really quite important. Nitin, what I wanted to follow up with what Christian was saying about the way in which to try to engage the multiplicity of things that are going on, and where that multiplicity oftentimes exceeds the available tools of analysis that we have, where we, you know, we can make sense of things only so far with what it is that we have, and sort of asking you, well, in your experience, what are those dimensions that seem to exceed being graspable? And Christian was identifying a kind of the spaces in between a certain kind of eventfulness of, when he was talking about it in Manila, in between clear notions of how things take place, as a potentially generative space, as a way in which to try to momentarily suture together, to make lines of connections by virtue of how we position ourselves within this sort of conundrum of uncertainty. And so I wanted to ask, you know, particularly because of your work within the sort of hinterlands of Delhi, where it's so clear that there are many different logics in the trajectories of urbanization and the way things are being both settled and unsettled, how you make sense of things that oftentimes don't make sense.
Thanks, Malik. I mean, just to continue on what Christian elaborated, and I think in Delhi, it's even I don't think it's unique, but it's even more sort of puzzling, the fact that it's not just the rural and urban space or the agrarian and sort of built-up space that sort of poses challenges in understanding space. You can have fields right next to a condominium and right next to it a tenement town, but it's also sort of forms of ecological space, of fallows, of transhumans actors, of non-sedentary and more than human actors that sort of present a unique challenge. There's still Delhi being sort of megapolis, so to say, in quotation marks, sort of has this, presents this imaginary that, you know, it has a hinterland that is somehow, okay, agrarian, but largely settled. But however, if you travel to the hinterland of Delhi, it's kind of quite unique. You still have a very large scale transhumans migration of nomads going with a really large pack of animals. You still observe that. And these sort of transhumans actors, they follow these sort of 9-month cycles around seasonality of water. You still have indigenous communities sort of with very different cosmologies of space still inhabiting the territory. You have so it's sort of I guess as a researcher, you have to be very fluid in terms of how you're engaging with these sort of cosmologies and with these sort of ecological apparatus also through which people are inhabiting the space. So you have a lot of industrial migrants. You have a sort of burgeoning middle class with all these condominiums. You have the local agrarian class. But at the same time, you also have transhumans actors. You have ecological contestations happening in spaces both within Delhi, in the hinterland, on the peripheries. So it is not just in the built, quote unquote, built space that this sort of in-betweens are happening, but also rather in terms of ecology and in terms of contestation to these sort of ecological fallows or Brache as is referred to in German.
Thank you, Nitin. I mean, this is a really important point about the heterogeneity of materialities that exist, you know, particularly outside of the built form and the ways in which those materialities act back and act in ways that are not subject to the imposition of our designs. And then Sobia, you work in Karachi, which is also a very eventful urban context. Could you share your thoughts on these questions?
Yeah, thank you, Malik. I think in Karachi, if I were to make sense of what it is that's too complex or difficult to understand or all over the place, I would say maybe it's the city itself. You know, it's just in much the same way that you describe in your work, you know, uncertainty has become context in Karachi. We've got frequent infrastructural breakdowns, you know, rainwater floods recur almost every year, similar to what Kristen said in his context. And at the same time, insecurity routinely interrupts people's lives. Whether in the case of, you know, terrorist attacks or muggings or, you know, routine political conflict. But in spite of all of these interruptions, people continue to go on with their daily lives. Karachi isn't a city that's suffering because of its unstable context. And this is sometimes something that has constantly surprised me. You know, with every visit, it's almost like the massiveness of the city, it gives renewed life and vigor and energy to it. It's quite sort of, you know, difficult to understand for me how this happens, especially as most of these events happen in predictable patterns. You know, so perhaps it's because of that, that everyday life does continue. So for example, electricity load shedding is most likely in the summer. Gas shortages are common in the winter. Phases of urban conflict and violence converge with electoral cycles. Massive floods are obviously most likely to happen in monsoon months. So, you know, people are prompted to take action and, you know, in anticipatory ways to respond to them. But every now and then, the intensity and scale of dysfunction just catches the public and city officials by surprise. So it's kind of grappling with this aspect of the massiveness of Karachi that sort of I find interesting. You know, why is it that this kind of uncertainty, sort of which is predictable, but then still comes by surprise? Why is it that it's ungovernable? I mean, is it because the city itself is unruly, or the urbanism is unruly? Or is it because we lack adequate government? Is it because the multitude of people living in Karachi have irreconcilable differences, you know, whether in the form of interests or politics? Or is it perhaps that citizens' divergent aspirations make it difficult for them to think and organize collectively? My opinion is that, you know, it's a little bit of this, you know, all of these things together. The city itself is increasingly exhausting. And the emergent politics is actually a reaction to the exhaustion that the constant sort of, you know, being on your toes causes for people living in the city. And it sort of leads to sort of all of these ad hoc incremental responses that sometimes aren't able to come together in very meaningful ways. But yes, I'm looking forward to thinking about this collectively a lot more with all of you.
Thank you, Sobia. Yeah, I mean, in the multiplicity of factors underway, the so many things to pay attention to, we may all recognize that these factors are at work, but it's oftentimes difficult to work out the proportionality of the more or less, you know, the percentage. And it's interesting that this inability to work out those proportions take place in an era where increasingly urban governance is based on calculating proportions, you know, what kinds of factors, what kinds of dynamics are at work in producing particular kinds of spatializations and realities. And so this is interesting dynamic in that particular relationship. Taibat, in Lagos is, within the popular imagination, often seen as one of the world's most ungovernable urban regions, but at the same time, its residents, often renowned as the most skilled at making things happen. So a kind of vast in-between in those different kinds of imaginaries. What is your sense of what's taking place?
Okay, thanks, Malik. I'll start by saying that there's a really strong conflicting rationalities of development in Lagos. First, you know, the government has this aspiration of being Africa's model megacity, and the reality on ground is vastly different. And so we have a city that is perpetually in flux, you know, always having these paradoxes and contradictions. Intense, you know, wealth living right next to intense poverty, the formal and informal intertwined, but against each other. And then, you know, these paradox of systems, you know, that clashing all the time, and everybody is having some form of discontent with the system. So that's a reality in Lagos. And the government really shies away from is the recognition of the informal, whereas it is that informal system that everybody uses to survive, even the rich. The city's systems, the city's infrastructure, the transactions, access to resources, access to basic services, access to transport, mobility, what have you. They are all based on the informal system. We have over 60% of the population of Lagos working in the informal economy, living in informal settlements, but the government is categorically, you know, disinclined to support this system whose agency is so manifest. So that's a major challenge with Lagos, that in the midst of all the chaos, you know, the one thing that works is not given recognition or support. And that's why, you know, the challenge is endemic, and that's why, you know, the city perpetually seems to be fighting itself.
Thanks, Taibat, and thanks for reminding us of the disjunctions between the persistence of political rationalities that in some ways still are convinced of a certain administrative logic, a certain kind of coherence, a certain kind of notion of planning, an administration that can somehow lend coherence to these multiplicity of different kinds of processes underway. And all of the kind of brokerage and negotiations and workarounds and circumventions and making do that actually sustain, in some ways, sustain that very, those very images of a kind of rationality. And yeah, so this sort of persistent disjunction between what is supposed to be workable and what actually then does work. And I guess my next question would be, well, you know, in the midst of these disjunctions, in the midst of these paradoxes, in the midst of these kind of dynamic in-between spaces, each of you has been involved in attempting to do things, either through advocacy or community planning, project development, public policy. You're not just researchers on this, you actually try to do things, you actually try to make things happen, despite the kinds of complexities of the context. And could perhaps you maybe just talk a moment about, well, what you've learned through your attempts to actually do things, and what this learning itself suggests about how we understand contemporary conditions, and in what ways these kinds of experiments in doing things could be perhaps generalized and institutionalized in some way. And so I'll return again to you, Christian, to lead off the discussion of this question.
Yes. Well, in kind of thinking about the case of Manila, perhaps one of the things that I would say is that there are kind of multiple strategies that people and communities take in securing a place in the city, in the periphery. Sometimes these strategies do not cohere, or they conflict with each other. And this too requires, I think, multiple plural strategies of engagement, which range, as Malika has mentioned, from public policy to forms of advocacies and support for movements, engaging social media, and kind of more experimental ways of presenting and representing these movements as well. And I think what is also needed is not so much kind of a new understanding of the city, but a sensitivity to the different ways that different elements cohere, or how new places, new contiguities, create new sets of relations and forms of socialities. So for example, in the case of Manila, where we have kind of a decade long policy to evict people along the waterways in guise of safety and climate change resilience, and then bring them to resettlement sites in the periphery that has created new forms of relations that are, or new geographies that are unruly, incomplete, and kind of difficult to understand at first. And therefore, this also requires kind of sensitivity to how to perhaps map or understand or grasp these new spaces. It can also entail perhaps the challenge of changing political configurations, and how, in the case of Manila, the challenges of a different political climate requires a different set of understanding the city, rooted in the past, but then also recognizing that what has happened in the past is different from what is currently happening now. So in the context of Manila, this takes the form of kind of a more hostile and violent movements against forms of urban dissent, which makes it more difficult for traditional and longstanding movements to kind of form mobilizations at the moment. And then this requires, I think, a rethinking of the strategies that many groups have used over the past few decades, which had been in part probably successful, but now is not as successful. So I think all these things would kind of need a sense of being sensitive to all these multiplicities on the ground and how they change through time. And it will entail looking at multiple avenues of action as well.
Thank you, Christian. And thanks for reminding us of the one of the ways in which certain kinds of actions are taken, particularly by governments, in the name of protecting the health and well-being of particular populations. I mean, the ways in which evictions oftentimes now take place in the interest of environmental protection. And so the way in which sometimes very pernicious actions continue to take place under the auspices of beneficial reasons often then forecloses particular kinds of actions and activism that we've relied upon in the past, and the need to rethink those. Nitin, could you please come in?
I think particularly in my work, I've been trying to understand this sort of Delhi without borders in a way. Like, the city, the massive urbanization, if you will, it's sort of somehow unbounded in a very fluid way. Like if you're in the region of Delhi, you can go for hundreds of kilometers without city ever ending. And at the same time, you have really, really important work like Gautam Bahn's work on planned illegalities, sort of translating into some sort of practice as well. Like, the whole IIHS and the work initiated by them in the city of Delhi on sort of evictions and a new form of practice that has emerged is very meaningful to engage in the city itself. But what I am experiencing in my work is that the city is not bound by this sort of borders anymore. The sort of city of Delhi itself, it exists as an entity of massive urbanization. So how do you sort of practice in this massive urbanization? So I guess I won't have any conclusory answers, but I started to engage with some practitioners. I attempted at doing some socially engaged art with an artist in one of these sort of planned illegalities or gray zones or tenement towns just outside Delhi. And I also worked on a film collaboratively with a friend of mine. And these sort of creative methodologies, they allow you to explore something that is that cannot be captured textually. It is very generative, these creative methodologies. So just to give you an example, in the socially engaged art, the artist I was collaborating with, she uses the Derif methodology from she does these sort of critical walks with people without sort of assuming something about this space. So this sort of allowed us to find so many possibilities of subversion of how people inhabit these territories as liminal beings. So just to give an example, we were working with garment manufacturing workers in one of these tenement towns. And we realized that 30 to 40% of the garment, when shirts are made or when jeans are made or any type of garment is made, goes directly to landfill. And the women in these tenement towns, if they don't find work, because it's sort of so precarious, everyday life is so precarious, they go and they imbue this sort of ecology of waste with a sort of labor of care. So it's sort of a form of reproduction that is able to produce really meaningful things out of this so-called waste. So they're able to make rugs, they're able to make bags. And if you enter one of these sort of rooms in a tenement building, it's full of just beautiful pieces of art, and the everyday life is quite imbued with this sort of labor of care. And I think this is what is missing, perhaps, when we sort of project extraplanetary gaze, so to say, on these territories of massive urbanization. So there's perhaps a need for sort of embedding ourselves a little bit more and understanding these sort of embodied politics everyday life that sort of happen below the thresholds of visibility.
Thank you, Nitin. I agree. I mean, the effective intensities of particular registers of urban inhabitation are such an important field to try to creatively and judiciously engage with. We think we know about the affect of suffering and anxiety and even of joy, but I don't think we know very much about the affect of what might be called a kind of generative sense of being unsettled, and the kinds of practices of care and improvisation and trying to make new kinds of ways of existing within those kinds of effective registers. So thank you for pointing this out. Sobia, you want to come in, please?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how, this collective ways of solving problems might be a solution to thinking about the ways in which massive urbanisms are lived or experienced, or the massiveness of it is encountered. So in my previous work, I did sort of think about how Karachiites from all walks of life, whether affluent or poor, were governing ongoing insecurity by living in communally organized and privately securitized enclave spaces. I mean, apparently they could be considered as collective spaces of care because they were self-organized, invested through private funds in response to ongoing uncertainty of insecurity, which the government wasn't doing anything about. These enclaves could be formally produced as walled or gated communities, but they could also be unwalled or informal settlements, which had produced some imagined geographies in other people's minds about them being inaccessible or unapproachable. And, they were securitized by a police production of sociopolitically homogenous space. So, I mean, in effect, they weren't on closer look, spaces of care at all, they were quite forcibly organized. Everyone had to conform to a particular sort of, set of rules and regulations, whether or not they agreed to it. But, you know, they were highly effective. And by way of their organization, you know, these spaces were able to produce some kind of order in a city that was otherwise uncertain. But at the same time, they also discursively reproduced urban difference more broadly for the rest of the city, because they generated binaries of us and them, you know, us inside sort of as a political block versus those outside who represent sort of everything that's wrong with the city, really. They also were organized by generating some kind of exclusive relationship between municipal officers and enclave governors. So in effect, these kinds of exclusive relationships called for competition between enclaves in accessing sort of limited public resources. And at the same time, these, you know, spatialized enclaves, they were they had psychosocial effects as well. You know, feelings of difference were exacerbated amongst urban communities, particularly along class and ethnic lines. This sense of, you know, anger, angst of how one community gets more than the other, like this kind of competition. But I think, you know, what's interesting sort of now, or what I have started to observe now, like it started to change my thinking a little bit. I also would like to think that these kinds of structures of care can work positively as well in the way that Nitin was talking about. This has become more apparent more recently with the emerging politics or response to the pandemic, as well as to the recent floods that took place in Karachi over the summer. It's quite obvious now that the working class militant political worker or the Afghan or Pashtun migrant worker isn't the problem. You know, they are not the enemy. Uncertainty and violence can also be caused by sort of, you know, forces that are beyond the person or beyond a particular ethnic or political group. And the current system, you know, by way of managing these kinds of insecurities through stopgap measures and quick fixes like hiring security guards or putting up walls or paying off some municipal officials, you know, it's not a solution for deeper rooted urban problems. And I feel like these events, more recent events, have kind of shaken people a little bit more and kind of brought the city together. People have become tired of privately investing in the city's development, of not holding the government responsible. And what I find especially interesting is that the middle class has had enough. They're finally protesting for what the working class has been protesting for decades, which is, you know, calling for effective and efficient public provision of municipal services. They're appropriating forms of manner of protest which have previously been thought of as vulgar and disruptive, you know, the same forms that, you know, the working class have worked with. So it's really exciting for me to observe emerging possibilities of cross-class and cross-cultural solidarities. And this overwhelming feeling of having had enough, which has allowed collective interests to finally converge. It's generating what I think the formation of a new public, one that can convene over physical as well as digital space. I do believe that a lot of work needs to be done to repair existing mistrusts and divides, which are very deep rooted. But perhaps there's also reason to be optimistic that the existing sort of political or spatial divides can perhaps be countered.
Thank you, Sobi, for these potentially heartening prospects, but also reminding us that, I mean, we all are concerned with the endurance of collective life, and I think your comments on enclaving oftentimes, I mean, enclaving point out the ways in which the place-based notions of collective life increasingly rely upon more a sense of homogeneity, a kind of more insular world, a more restrictive kind of engagement with a larger city in order to be sustained. And it prompts a need to rethink more the notion of collective life in motion and in circulation and away from sort of our territorially based notions of neighborhood and community. And particularly when you point out the sort of the exhaustion of the middle class, I mean, the way in which middle-class attainment was often based on itself a kind of restriction, a focus on respectability around acquiring particular kinds of disciplines and vernaculars that shape behavior in ways that were themselves restrictive of a kind of capacity to engage other spaces of other people. And so in some sense, the exhaustion of the middle class might be then a way in which to rethink a different set of vernaculars and performances and behaviors that perhaps may be more extensive in their own way. Thai Bhatt, can you share some of your experience with your long career of activism and project development in Lagos?
All right, Malik, thank you. It's raining here, so I'm not sure how well the connection is, but I'll just go ahead. So, you know, my work, I've learned a few things. The first is that people have agency and they will reinvent the city to suit their purposes regardless of what government says. And that has been brought, you know, very clearly to light with, you know, for example, with the slum communities doing waste field to create land. And that is illegal, whereas the we have a Ministry of Waterfront Infrastructure that grants dredging licenses to the wealthy to actually dredge the lagoon to create islands of exclusion for the very wealthy. So we have that going on side by side, where lack of access to land, particularly for the lower income, they have to go ahead and create their own land. You have the ambulance of the street traders who are perpetually reinventing how they engage on the street, from having the table with the umbrella to now having the vests, you know, to sell their recharge cards, to having the homeless who identify the task force trucks and are able to communicate miles ahead for others to get off the street and reconvene thereafter. So you have, you know, people, regardless of what government says or how government's vision of the city, you know, is, they keep reinventing the city to suit their purposes. And also with the closing of our civic spaces over the last decade or so, the public space has now extended onto the virtual. And so you have a very active activist population online, particularly on Twitter. And the NSAS protest, for example, the organization and the mobilization and the organization over the 12 or so days that those protests lasted before the government intervened with violence, it was all on Twitter. And it was a largely informal, you know, collaboration among young people or young Nigerians from across the world. And they were able to organize and stand, you know, against government to protest against police brutality, bad governance, and what have you. And that, you know, the government's only response to that is to try to...
Thai Bhatt, in the rain, if you want to take off from where we left, please.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So I was saying that there's also a need to collaborate with local communities, practice a form of urbanization at scale, I will call it. So I was involved with the Lagos Resilience Strategy, which was a top-down process to kind of document the government's visioning or opinion of what resilience is and how the city can be more resilient. And then more recently, during the COVID lockdown, I was involved in a community resilience action plan, which was a totally different process that was more grounded, starting from the community themselves. They were able to articulate their priorities. And more importantly, they were able to say how they wanted, you know, these priorities to be addressed and also how they were going to contribute to making the priorities, you know, sustainable. And I found that really refreshing, that because oftentimes we cast this toga of illegality or shirking from responsibility on the poor. Whereas in the case where they are part of the planning or the city building process, they are willing to have a stake in it and, you know, actually contribute to making things happen. And the third thing I learned is that if the city is going to work, then we must recognize the non-formal institutions. First, we have the gatekeepers and the purveyors of violence, like in the context of Lagos, the road transport unions, but also those who wield community influence and wield trust, like the traditional institutions and the market unions. We discovered during these last protests that when the protests turned violent and some of the hoodlums took over and started to vandalize properties and all of that, it was the traditional authorities, the community development groups, who stood to protect their communities. As at that time, we did not, you know, to all intents and purposes, we didn't have the police on the streets. The government had lost control, but communities were able to stand to protect, you know, their areas from being vandalized or from the outsiders coming in with violence. And so I think it's important that we recognize these grounded level types of urban development and urban reconfiguration, and recognize that they are key to ensuring that the city, you know, continues to grow, because the city is an amalgam of these small communities. And if the agency, the strength of these communities are not enhanced, you know, we will keep going around in circles where we have these big, grandiose ideas that at the end of the day never sees the light of day.
Oh, thank you, Taibat, for these reflections. There are several things that you said that really, really stand out. One was the notion of reinvention. I mean, we oftentimes think of certain kinds of informal activities as simply compensation of ones of need to support absolute need. And of course they may be these things, but when you emphasize reinvention, it's this ongoing capacity to do something differently. And these reinventions have particular effects, and these effects oftentimes are not always anticipated. And so they do open up new directions, no matter how, with what limited resource they may have. Then you said something really interesting about in terms of the campaign to stop the sort of special forces policing that has been in the news during the last month. And you said you referred to Nigerians all around the world, and that reminds us of the ways in which particular cities are platforms for their own globality. So one can imagine Lagosians in Johannesburg and Hong Kong and Delhi and East London and Dallas and Sao Paulo, all through social media, doing their own contributions to the anti-SARS campaign. And then finally, when you talk about the need for non-formal institutions, that regardless of their formality or not, that they remain institutions, that they have their own authorities, that they engender a particular kind of trust and deploy particular kinds of efficacies in their actions. And sometimes we forget that there are a kind of multiplicity of that they are institutions, and the need to engage them as such as part of the process of city building. Perhaps maybe a final question for you to consider is that, I mean, given all that we've talked about in terms of the kind of analytical challenges, in terms of grasping the kinds of complexities of urban transformation underway, and what you've learned through your own work, what might you see as the kind of most viable urban manifestations of urban politics that can deal with issues of spatial injustice, economic precarity, and social marginalization? So if you were to envision the sort of key elements of a kind of urban politics that might be able to begin to effectively address these kinds of issues, what might you conclude around this? So we'll return maybe to Christian for your set of reflections.
Yes, thanks, Malik. I'm trying to think of kind of the multiplicity of where such political experimentations could happen and could be in forms of massive mobilizations and movements, but also in the context of situating it in the everyday as a site of kind of political experiment. And I think for me, the way I understand the everyday is a way of opening up possibilities. So I think I'm thinking of a couple of examples from my and other colleagues' work in Manila. So one would be the example of urban farming. So it's a kind of an example of a very in-between space that in a way subverts vision of Manila and what kind of a city should be. And it's a site of conflict, exclusion, and perhaps even state subjectification. But in my experience with talking to farmers, urban farmers, I see it also as a site of possibilities and opportunities to ensure livelihood, make room for maneuver, given the constraints of kind of this dense, very non-green city. So farmers are not only invested in ensuring that their plants survive or that they harvest well, but are also conscious about their place in the community, in the city that they are a part of. And this is not to overstate kind of the political importance of growing own food and how it is able to overcome broader questions of political economy and justice. And in the context in Manila, it remains marginal in terms of food security and income benefits that it gives people. But in a way, I think it presents kind of this site or avenue of inhabiting the city by working with the urban environment. It becomes a point of engagement with what it means to be in the city or be a resident, a citizen of a city. And it also provides space to deal in many ways with the state. And the other example I could think of in the context of everyday is how we could perhaps look at alternative mapping of spatialities of these spaces. In some of my colleagues' work, we have conducted forms of counter mapping, and this is has kind of an expanded meaning. It's not just producing maps, kind of an alternative to the maps of the state and development plans, but also kind of thinking of the spatialities of the everyday and everyday practices beyond the map, also exploring multiple forms of performances and art and other ways of representing space and how people inhabit these every day. And I think these are two modest examples of how we can situate the political in the context of the massiveness of all that is going on in Manila, in my case.
Thank you, Christian. Yeah, as a fan of movies about urban Manila, I can't remember ever seeing a film about Manila where you where you have urban farming taking place. So sometimes to work through that which is most unexpected or unfamiliar is a particularly generative way to go. And also the importance of thinking through new forms of mapping of spaces. Sometimes we're oftentimes are too set within the kinds of administrative boundaries of what is a particular district or zone, and they don't really correspond with the sort of the territories of operation for residents, the actual spaces and networks that they transverse every day to be able to put together forms of a viable livelihood. So different tools and ways of mapping the way in which actual territories of inhabitation are made is particularly important. Nitin, do you want to come in?
Thanks, Malik. I think I would really sort of agree with Christian's analysis. I think I have a very similar observation on a sort of a massive but unspectacular environmental politics shaping up in this sort of Delhi without borders or this massive urban region, where you have, just to give an example, there is a very large move to sort of redesign and enclose the largest public space in Delhi, which happens to be at the center on this axis, old imperial axis of the sort of what is called the Lutyens Delhi, colonial part of Delhi. The sort of resistance against this project is largely environmental. All sort of forms of resistance to save this space that argued for aesthetics or particular forms of dwelling failed, but the large part of resistance that sort of was able to successfully subvert this plan was largely environmental. So you had really young people coming and mapping out the trees that exist there, the different type of species and how these species interact with sort of the human environment, and how this is key to sort of these questions of habitability as well. There is a politics of habitability that sort of intersects with the politics of with environmental politics in Delhi. You have sort of quartzite mines on the periphery, where you have this sort of middle-class collectives which are trying to re-energize these sort of old mining pits into forests through planting with careful detail indigenous trees that are local to those environments. But you also have deep in the hinterland, also another type of environmental politics that's shaping up around similar issues of protecting certain forms of indigenous trees because from sort of projects of large-scale infrastructure like the Delhi-Mumbai Expressway, which is a 150-meter-wide expressway, which is sort of passing through a lot of these sacred forests and agricultural commons in the hinterland, where you have a similar kind of politics shaping up around subverting this development based on counting the number of trees and biodiversity you have and sort of protecting it. So I think similar to Christian, there's some sort of massive environmental politics that's shaping up in Delhi.
Yeah, and in ways that are not simply about environmental protection or sustainability within the kind of conventional sense, but in a way in which there are all of these different initiatives to enfold and engage different kinds of ecological formations as part and parcel of ways of exploring new forms of livelihood and inhabitation.
Yes, Malik, I just wanted to add there, it's also, there's also resurgence of sacredness towards this sort of biodiversity. So there's definitely some sort of new ecological formations as well, as you rightly pointed.
Yeah, it reminds me of the work of our colleague Sally Benjamin in Chennai, who talks about the insistence upon the sacred in terms of everyday land politics and enduring occupations on the part of particularly the poor. So the notion of the sacred continues to be, repurposed in a lot of different ways, not always generative ones, as you well know, but that's an important to point out. Sobia?
So I've been thinking of this question in a different way. Like, I mean, I definitely agree with Nitin's and Christian's and Tybet's sort of engagement with it. But I would like to draw attention not just to the issues and forms of political experiments, but also to the sites within which political experiments take place or are situated. So in particular, I've been looking at the production of alternative platforms of public engagement in the way of social media and how it's becoming so popular as a way of generating sort of debate, organizing protests, or just sort of expressing a public mood in a country which is increasingly stifling freedom of protest and expression. So, you know, I found that these forms of democratic exchange are, you know, limited by cultural, social, or political norms at present. So social media for me has been an interesting sort of site of political experimentation. So it's not just a medium of communication, I think, but, you know, the kinds of communication or the forms that it makes possible. So things like poetry, images, memes, these are developed in being developed. They bring together a particular kind of sort of subject position by people who produce them. You know, the kind of hopes and fantasies that the sharing or making something viral creates for them, the circulation of these through platforms like YouTube, Facebook, WhatsApp. In creating this content and sharing it and sort of in it being circulated, it kind of builds a structural feeling that extends across and perhaps maybe sometimes even problematizes existing racial, gender, class, or cultural norms or divides. So I do think that these platforms, you know, are increasingly being democratized because of mass availability of mobile phones and free access to some of these apps. So, you know, and in doing so, a new public space of interaction and negotiation has started to emerge. And this is very exciting for me to observe, especially as I've been sitting in a distance and been mourning or grieving, sort of not being able to sort of go to Karachi physically sort of because of the pandemic and also because of, you know, restrictions on travel and everything. But I've also been, I mean, in making these observations and following all of these issues about sort of, you know, some sites being shut down by government and then debates around how, like TikTok, for example, the government put it down because apparently it led to, according to the government, the production of lewd material or immoral material. And this was basically a way of policing women's bodies because a lot of female stars had come up sort of making content and sharing them on and some of these sort of, you know, ordinary content producers. I mean, some of them are farmers, some of them are women, like belong to low-income groups, but also creating or having a massive following or political clout. And sometimes the discussions they had, you know, verged on the political, and this was deemed then dangerous by the state who wanted to shut these voices down. And this led to sort of a counter argument by the Twitterati, who is a lot more internationally sort of recognized, which basically sort of, argued for the fact that, you know, there's a lot more lewd material on Twitter and there's a lot more access to immoral sort of content on YouTube or Twitter, and why aren't these forums being shut down? Maybe there's something about power over here where the government feels like TikTok is a medium that's used and produced and shared amongst people of a certain socioeconomic class, which Twitter and Facebook and YouTube isn't in as many ways. So, you know, why isn't the government shutting these kind of mediums down? So, I mean, I just found these kinds of conversations on social, like on the politics of what kinds of mediums are allowed and what aren't allowed, very interesting. Eventually, TikTok has been reallowed or has been resumed. But also in sort of observing how these mediums have been used for urban protests or for mobilizing coordinated action in response to, so for example, the floods, following poetry that has been produced that sort of awakens a kind of feeling amongst Karachiites on the nostalgia of what they've lost by way of their loss of politics. Also the comments which a lot of these videos might generate, you could say, or even posts on organizing protests, we are going to meet at a particular public space at this many hours, and then, images of women holding up placards. I mean, what these kinds of images do to produce a particular idea of who it is that's inhabiting space and, which voices are being projected, but also who all is invited. For me, it's been interesting to observe, really. And I do think that, the opening up of digital space as a way of conversation is also a great way of bridging the kind of divides that I was speaking of across class, across culture, across politics as well, especially for Pakistani society, where there is something that we called, jhijak, which is an Urdu word, which roughly translates to apprehensive hesitation or something like cultural formality, some kind of, rules about who you can speak to and who you can't speak to. So I feel like social media allows interaction between strangers and the public. It allows interaction across class, across gender, in a way that physical space doesn't. So these forms of contents, or these kinds of platforms rather, and what they do in their sharing or in the circulating, when they're just being present in digital space, create a kind of politics, like a momentum for a kind of politics that can then perhaps be, experienced or lived or even reacted in public space, in physical public space. So I think that's an interesting point of political experiment, a form of political experiment to consider.
Thanks, Sobi. As Christian and Nitin were talking about the environmental ecologies, this is an important point about the notion of media ecologies and the ways in which these ecologies give rise to practices that engender particular structures of feeling and become opportunities to rehearse different ways of being together. And of course, those rehearsals, as rehearsals, are going to be messy and problematic and oftentimes fraught with tensions. They do offer a kind of platform of experimentation in the ways in which you have so well articulated. And then finally, Taibat, you had also had mentioned the importance of social media as a kind of political instrument in Lagos. But what else would you see as a kind of emerging viable politics in your context?
Thank you. Well, the two things that readily come to mind is one, collaboration of the middle class, much of which takes place on social media. And then we have the bourgeois class trying to stretch a hand. And so they're able to somewhat articulate some of the agitations of those who are lower down the ladder through art, through music, and through things like walkabout, community engagement, charitable work, and all of that. While it helps to cast a lens on the issues. Sometimes we query how impactful it is on, you know, the local communities outside of the public adulation that these middle class allies, in quote, you know, benefit. So that's on the one hand. The other thing is the collaboration with the faith-based organizations. I think in the last 5 or 6 years, when local communities started to mobilize their alliance with faith-based organizations, many of whom, you know, work with these communities to provide support services, particularly where government is lacking, have helped to give some kind of credence to the agitations. So you have faith-based organizations, even during the NSAS, you know, coming out and speaking out about the validity of the issues that had been raised and the fact that, you know, something really needs to change. So they tend to give an air of respectability and kind of convict government to come to the table. We've seen that with issues around the Federation of the Urban Poor and issues around evictions that some of the churches had taken on board. The incidence of evictions around those areas had been stemmed because, you know, the churches came out and spoke against the the practices and were actively supporting those communities, sometimes in defying government, sometimes in resettling. And then with the middle class, while some of them have been able to open up their platforms to have these conversations, the good it has done is to bring the conversations to the fore. So many in the city who had taken up the issue of, oh, people shouldn't live like that as an excuse for, you know, as a defense or as a justification for why these evictions should go on, have now come to realize that it's people who live in those communities. And while people shouldn't live like that, they also shouldn't be rendered homeless and, you know, bereft of their dignity and their sense of place. So the conversation is slowly turning around because of these allies. It's coming to the fore. So we're having this conversation, but how impactful it will be long, middle class have short attention span, you know, sometimes other issues come up, but how impactful, how long term, particularly with the political actors who often don't see their interventions beyond one cycle. So I stop there for now.
Thanks, Taibat. And what you raise is a really important point about the kinds of strategic intricacies of maintaining a kind of functional, viable sense of political struggle, of how one sort of has the patience to maintain relationships with particular kinds of class formations and institutions that oftentimes are difficult to maintain over the long run, but eventually oftentimes prove to be critical allies in terms of attaining at least small victories. So this question of how long do you stick with it, you know, and under what circumstances, and who calls the shots in terms of maintaining these alliances? These are all really important and critical questions to pay attention to in an urban politics which ultimately has very kinds of complex strategic considerations. So thank you for this. I think that perhaps before we close, that I might step back a moment, and if any of you want to make some final comments or to ask each other some questions, that we might do that now. So if anyone has anything you want to ask of each other, any kind of final comments to be made, let's do that now.
I just wanted to say that it's been a very interesting discussion and place of learning, actually, not just the podcast today, but the whole massive urbanization school that you've put together, Malik. So I've learned a lot from these different contexts and the politics shaping within them.
Yeah, thanks, Nitin. I mean, this is what we had in mind, you know, a kind of ongoing collective effort where we all learn from each other, try to support and care for each other, and to, in our own work, exemplify the kinds of political experiments and imaginations that we all have. And I really have come to value these kinds of interchanges so much, and I'm so grateful for all of your willingness and your work.
I would like to say thank you as well to all of you. Honestly, this has been a very, very productive space of thinking and learning and rationalizing and making sense of what otherwise seems to be quite sort of, you know, a different, difficult to grasp subject. I mean, looking at the urban context that we're looking at with so many multiplicities of sort of, you know, kinds of politics, of forms of living, of structures of spaces, of possibilities, and sort of how to grasp it. So it's been very exciting to know that there's so many strong parallels across some of the contexts that we're looking at. So thank you all very much.
Yes, and I would also echo Sobia and Nitin's points. I think what I found very exciting in a way is how we are kind of able to experiment in a way, coming up with collectively with vocabularies or perhaps other ways of understanding what is going on with our cities, but also beyond, kind of in a comparative and also beyond comparative mode. So I think that's what I appreciate a lot.
Okay, and I'll end by saying thank you very much. I've seen a lot of similarities, Lagos and Karachi especially, and then to some extent with Delhi and Metro Manila. And it's actually been a learning process as well for me. And then, you know, it allows us to really interrogate how we're looking at the city and are there other methods? Are there other ethnographies? Are there other methodologies or lenses through which we will look at these everyday seeming, you know, everyday processes that may have deeper meanings for development?
Absolutely. Completely agree, Talbot.
Okay, thanks everyone. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Marcus.
Thank you for sharing your time and these absolutely intriguing insights.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.